There have been, as you know, and you know from the news media, there's been increasing number and severity of heat waves. There's been more severe storms, and these aren't necessarily just the hurricanes either. We have more days of heavy rainfall. You remember the great floods of 2010 here?
I certainly do. Very vividly.
So that wasn't a coastal storm. That was just a lot of rain over a short amount of time, and the inability of our infrastructure to handle that amount of water. So we see rising levels of ozone in this area. So ozone is linked to more asthma attacks in kids, more higher risk of developing asthma in the first place.
So there's a correlation between that rising ozone and childhood asthma,
yes.
The incidence of...
Absolutely.
And severity of...
The frequency of exacerbation. There's twofold. One is that your kid is more likely to develop asthma if they live in a high ozone environment. And then on days of high ozone, they're more likely to have an asthma attack, conditional on having asthma.
Okay, we're seeing this now.
Yeah.
So that's significant. You were talking increased heat wave.
Yeah.
So obviously during a heat wave,
yep.
Different people are impacted different ways. If
yes.
you have COPD, for example,
yeah.
your health suffers.
Right.
Correct. Yes, that is true.
Yeah, it is true. So COPD, there's a higher risk of hospitalization on very hot days for everybody, but we think that there's some particularly susceptible individuals, including people with asthma, people with COPD, the elderly. I was going to say children. We think children. There's not a lot of data. So one of Kate's research interests is to really dive into that, is what are the effects of extreme heat on children?
Oh.
Because you'll hear the mantra very often of kids are more susceptible to these effects, but there's almost no data on that.
Yeah.
And so...
So that's sort of pioneering research,
yeah,
as it were.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, what's your name again?
My name is Kate Weinberger.
Okay, and you're a fellow?
I'm a postdoctoral fellow right now.
At the School of Public Health?
At the School of Public Health. Greg's my mentor, so...
Okay, good.
Let me sit in on
this. She's
done
a lot of the research that we'll be talking about. So.
Okay.
And I think going back to, you were sort of mm-hmm. listing groups that we think are probably vulnerable to extreme heat. I think you would probably also agree that people with underlying cardiovascular disease.
Sure.
You said older adults.
Mm-hmm.
I think outdoor workers for sure.
Yeah.
And then student athletes are another group that we sometimes
sure.
think about as vulnerable to heat,
right.
because
people
they're outside.
People don't have the
often,
option
right.
of not being outside. So
yeah.
that, you know, that's where your roofers and landscapers and agricultural workers for sure come in. But right, also student athletes that are, you know, while we're all sort of in the shade, sunning ourselves, you know, fanning ourselves thinking how hot it is, the kids are actually out playing.
Yeah, there have been some
yeah.
notorious cases in the last couple of years
yeah.
where
yeah.
coaches have...
push too hard, right?
Yeah.
That's a polite way to put
right.
it. But yes. Okay, so that's here and now.
So I think that's a super important point of any piece on climate change, is that for too long we framed this as sort of a problem either far away in time or far away in space. Like, this is about polar bears or penguins or small Pacific islands. And it's not. It is those things, but it's much more important because it's your kids, your families, your communities. When we talk about flooding, we don't need to go to small Pacific islands. We can look at Rhode Island with its 400 miles of coastline.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of risk of flooding, as I say, even when we don't have coastal storms, even just for heavy rainfall events. We have the heat right here. There's since about 1960, when T.F. Green started the weather station there, started keeping temperature records, there's about 21 more days of high heat every summer today than there was, you know, 40 years ago.
How do you define high heat? Is there a number we assign to that? I'm guessing
since
you're a scientist,
right,
there's
exactly.
a number.
So, you know, we can look at either high temperature, days of, say 90 degrees or above,
mm-hmm.
or we can look at heat index, which is this combination of temperature and humidity that the National Weather Service likes to use. So I can send you those figures
okay.
and you can see the histogram just showing you, like, how many days by different thresholds do you have now versus 30, 40 years ago?
So each of those additional days, heat yeah. days, will have an effect on the populations that we're talking about. At yes. least some of
yes.
the You'll members of the
at
group.
Least some increased risk of death and some increased risk of visiting the emergency department because of a variety of conditions.
Is there a mental health element to this in terms of stress? I'm just imagining I've got COPD, mm-hmm. Elderly, mm-hmm. I'm poor, so mm-hmm. maybe I can't afford air conditioning, mm-hmm. and I get a heat wave, so I'm struggling to breathe. It's more than simply the effect on my physiology, is it not?
Absolutely. Do you want to take that one, Kate?
Yeah, I think generally there's an increasing interest in quantifying the potential mental health impacts you're talking specifically about extreme heat and heat waves, but I think there's a broader interest, wouldn't you say,
yeah.
in the research community in trying to understand the mental health consequences of flooding events, of heavy rainfall, of coastal storms like hurricanes.
Of the devastation of the 2010 rains here and sort of how much, you know, mental stress that applied to people. Now imagine that it happens again. So having your house flooded is traumatic once. Having your house flooded a second time is devastating to people.
Yeah.
And, you know, in relation to other sort of severe natural disasters, there has been a documented rise in things that look like PTSD and increased rates of depression. I think in terms of the present day health effects, the ones that are best studied are really the heat, air pollution, primarily there, you know, for climate relevance, we think primarily of ozone, heavy rains, and severe storms in this area of the country. And if you think towards the west of the U.S., you think a lot about wildfires.
Sure, also California being case number one.
Right,
yeah.
The wildfire season is virtually year-round now in California, even though California, I think, is no longer in drought.
I think that's correct.
But they're still having record wildfire seasons, so that's all tied in. So those are the primary effects. I guess here we also talk about infectious diseases, maybe West Nile virus, but you know, tick-borne diseases,
Lyme disease.
And why is that? Because more ticks, or
yeah, the ticks aren't dying in the winter like they used to. So you know, when the winters are cold enough that gets to deep freeze, there's an optimal range of temperature for the ticks and for the virus in the tick. And now it's as it gets warmer, the range over which ticks can live and survive is moving northward.
What about pollen?
Actually, before I came here, when I was a doctoral student, my work was primarily on sort of links between climate and meteorology and the pollen season effects on people who have allergies or allergic asthma. I guess the broad message is that aspects of the pollen season, so when the pollen season starts, how long the pollen season lasts, how much pollen is produced over the course of the season, all of those sort of dimensions of the pollen season are sensitive to weather and climate. So for example, warmer winters have been linked to advances in the start date of the pollen season. And then there's also, I think really interestingly from a climate change perspective, there's some evidence, a lot of it done in ragweed. So ragweed affects people who have, is present during the late summer and fall. And
yeah,
so you see
particularly
people
bad
getting symptoms. And so there's some evidence in ragweed that actually increased concentrations of CO2 have a direct impact on the amount and the potency of the pollen
really?
Produced by ragweed.
Meaning so more pollen.
Yes.
So two things. One
yes.
is that there's more pollen more of the year, and that each gram of or microgram of pollen that you capture induces more allergies in people. So it's more pollen and that pollen is more allergenic.
Yeah.
So if you think that your allergies are getting worse, it's probably because they are, right? At least in a lot of people.
Yeah.
Are we seeing new species of plants coming north, invasive species, or that might add to pollen, or is that
So the short answer is yes, but I'm not an expert in that, so I won't comment sort of beyond that.
We could point you to somebody who could, or I can point you to somebody.
So the ecology people worry a lot about that, about sort of the range of trees and is the maple tree still going to be doing well in this area? Maple syrup's an important part of, the New England mentality and culture, but that's under threat from climate change. But again, our focus is on the human health effects, so I just don't have expertise in that.
Okay. People generally accept that it's going to get worse, not better. Does that not have an effect on anxiety, or could it have an effect?
Yeah, so there's a great series of studies from the Yale Climate Communication Center, I think they're called. Basically, they talk about the six Americas, which is, that we don't really have climate believers and deniers. We have this spectrum of opinions from people that are very concerned, which is, a small percent to people that, but growing over time, to people that are, sort of somewhat concerned, attentive to, sort of disengaged, and to the outright disbelievers. And the outright disbelievers are a very vocal, especially politically vocal force, but it's actually a pretty small number. I think it's less than 15% right now in the latest round. So so that gives us hope that to change the debate, it's not about convincing the deniers that, this is real and this is something that they need to adopt. It's only about moving some people from the middle, from just this side of the middle to just that side of the middle. So there's actually, I think, and there's been huge progress on that. If you sort of compare the numbers from, today versus 5 years ago, 10 years ago, the trend is moving in what we would call the right direction. So I think that gives us a lot of hope. I think in terms of the mental stress, the psychologists that I've heard talk about this say that, this is why it's so hard to get people to engage in this, because it feels like such an overwhelming problem. It's so big, it's so dramatic, I can't possibly make a difference. And on the other hand, we know that just like with voting, the only way to change things is if we all make a small difference. And so there's this cognitive dissonance between, we know we have this big problem that we need to, tackle, but what could we possibly do about it? And there's so much going on. I mean, it doesn't even need to be like the Paris Accord globally. You look at, more than half of the world's population lives in cities, and cities around the world are doing so much to reduce their carbon footprint, improve air quality, broadly improve environmental health. And so I think, we are, too slow and not enough, but we are moving in the right direction. And I think the message, hopefully, whenever I do an interview like this, I want to emphasize sort of that it's not too overwhelming. It's not unsolvable. There is hope, because I think if we overwhelm people with like a negative sort of, oh, it's doom and doom, that's not helpful.
You mentioned voting. Voting is important.
Yep.
Is it not at the local, the city, state, and national level?
Absolutely. My town just, elected a new mayor maybe a year or two ago.
Who did?
My town, the town where I live.
Where do you live?
Massachusetts.
What town?
Newton.
Oh, okay.
And it was interesting because all the candidates were sort of tripping over themselves to say like how proactive they would be on the environment and on mitigating carbon emissions for the city. And in fact, the winner was very sort of had a strong platform on that. And she has, now negotiated aggregate purchasing of electricity so that every Newton house is automatically enrolled in 60% renewable energy. Sort of, you can opt out of that, but because
it's pretty cool
aggregate purchase, it's also like I think my electric bill went up on average by like $2 a month, which is like I can do that.
Yeah, right.
And I have the option for like another $2 a month of going to 100% renewable energy. So it
that's
matters
great.
At
that's
a local
great
level,
yeah.
Right? Massachusetts has 352 cities and towns. So, it's slow, but it's exactly the right direction. Because if I put solar panels on my roof, that's, that's a drop in the bucket. But now if you do something like this across the whole city, now you're actually talking of change. And like, imagine if Boston did that, or, Cambridge, some of the other bigger communities, Worcester, Rhode Island doesn't have a similar aggregation program, although I think they've been debating it for a long time. But again, right, imagine if that was sort of just the default option on your electric bill. It's like, it's just like saving for retirement. If you make it the default option that you will save some, many more people do it, and it makes a huge difference. It's so important to frame this as a health issue today.
Yeah.
You know, for too long it's been framed as an environmental issue. And of course it is an environmental issue, but we care about it because we have to live in this environment. Yeah. And the changing climate has already affected how we live, work, and play right here in our own backyards, right? So wherever you live in the country, you've been impacted by this, whether you know it or not. And, you know, the things where we make money, you know, are sort of the fisheries, the agriculture, tourism affected, the places we like to play. Again, recreational skiing in New England, is hard to run a ski hill in New England because the winters aren't as cold for as long as they used to be. So even the nighttime lows have to be below freezing for them to make snow. That we have fewer and fewer of those days. So these sort of pretty much touching on every aspect of, again, how we live, work, and play. There has to be hope. If not, why should people be concerned? It's like, if, you know, we shouldn't, there's no need to pay attention to the news, to the problems, if it's so overwhelming that there's no hope. And there is hope. There's legitimately hope, but also we need to believe in that hope in order to take every next step to get there. And we will. And the message is there, that there's really no disagreement that these things are happening and that it is having a profound impact on our lives, on every aspect of our lives, wherever you live, in your community, in your backyard. But there's also no doubt that there's hope, that this is entirely a solvable problem, that we're already making great strides to avert the worst of the consequences. There's also no doubt that we need to do much, much more, but it is within our grasp to do it, both as you know, society at large, kind of the global society, but also individually and as small communities. So right, we can do this, and we must do this for, as you said, for our kids and our grandkids.